familiar passage, a familiar story. The Magi coming to worship the Christ child. They may have been kings, and look at Beatrice with her beautiful, Divine with her beautiful crown on. Oh, if you want someone to make you a crown, just ask, because there's plenty there. Magi were a caste of priests in Persia. They were magicians, astrologers, who worshipped other gods. And they searched the stars for signs. And they are all things that God tells the Israelites not to do in the Old Testament. They were forbidden activities in the law of the Lord. The Magi were from the east, so they were Gentiles, which means they did not belong to the people of God. We call them kings. And maybe somebody sat down one time and worked out that you'd have to be rich to make this journey. So therefore you must perhaps have been a king, because who else would be that rich? But it's not so. There was one king of Babylon, a powerful king of Babylon. And if anyone else had pipped up and said, oh yeah, but I'm the king of this little bit here, well, they would have been dealt with, shall we say, and leave it there. The idea that there's a bunch of kings getting together and leaving their kingdoms to go off on a journey, it just doesn't stand up. I was going to make a joke about Emperor Musk, but I thought I better not, because I'll get told it's inappropriate. They were not kings. And then we call them wise men. Now, such a thing may exist, Cherry. You know, I allow the idea of a wise man must exist. In fact, I've met some. Some of these magi may have been wise, but being magi did not make you wise. Perhaps we call them wise because they came to worship Jesus. And wise men still worship Jesus, as do wise women, wise children. So this visit in Matthew chapter 2 by Persian magi to see a new king is not the only one that's recorded in ancient history. It's the only one we can find in the Bible, but it's not the only one in history. When the new Emperor Nero was born many years later, we read in histories that a group of magi from a distant land came to worship him. Came to pay homage to the king. It wasn't just this Matthew chapter 2 one, and it's reinforced in the histories of ancient people, what we read about in the Bible. In the Old Testament, in 1 Kings chapter 10, we read how the Queen of Sheba came to visit King Solomon because she'd heard about his great wisdom. She came to visit Solomon and she brought him gold and precious stones as gifts, along with more spices than anyone in Jerusalem had ever seen. Did you get spices for Christmas, anyone? Mixed spice. So these magi came paying homage to a new king. They had seen a star, and they believed that this star signified the birth of a king, not someone who was born to become king, but someone who was born king. Tell me where you'd look if you were looking for a king. In a palace. Stands to reason, doesn't it? Sensible. I would. If I was looking for a king, I'd start at the palace. It was suggested to me once, and I discounted it, that at least one of the Magi must have been a woman, because men never stop to ask for directions. I think if one of the Magi had been a woman, they would have bought sensible gifts like nappies and casseroles and a broom to sweep the stable, but I'm just joking, as you know. They went to Herod's palace in Jerusalem, which we understand, which we can see exactly what they did, but oh my days, what a bad move that was. Understandable, but not good. And in Matthew chapter 2 from verse 3, it said, when Herod heard this news about this new king and the star, he was disturbed. Herod was violent and insecure, and it's no wonder, it says in here, that the whole of Jerusalem was disturbed, because they knew if Herod was disturbed, then someone was going to be hurt. A few years ago, I found these little historical factoids about King Herod, and I looked them up again. King Herod had 10 different wives. 10 different wives. We don't know if that meant he had 10 mothers-in-law or not, but we do know that he had at least one of his mother-in-laws executed. Just the one. King Herod made his will 6 times. Not 6 times one after the other, but 6 at the same time. And in each of those 6 wills, he left his crown to a different one of his children. Well, how to cause murder after you've died. Those little factoids are not recorded in the Bible, but they're recorded by the Romans in the histories, and they do tie in with what we find about King Herod here in the Bible. They reinforce the words of the scriptures. If Herod was upset, someone was going to be in danger, because Herod cared more about grasping onto his own power than he cared about what God was doing. And then Herod did something that just leaves me so puzzled every single time I read this. It leaves me with questions, because if we look in Matthew chapter 2 from verses 3 to 6, it says, Herod sent for his religious advisors and he asked them where God's Christ would be born. The Magi didn't say they'd come looking for the Messiah, for God's Christ. So how did Herod know? What made Herod make that immediate leap between this group of wise astrologers who'd made this big long journey and were looking for the king, and what he knew but ignored about God's Christ? And if Herod had cottoned on that this newborn king was God's Christ, why did Herod think he could thwart God's plan? Herod's advisors, we find, told him that God's Messiah, the king in the line of David, would be born in Bethlehem in Judea. And they referred Herod to the scriptures and told him where he could find this information for themselves. And this is my next question. They were the religious advisors. And if they knew this about God's Messiah, why didn't they go and worship him as well? So, story so far. Gentile magi searching the stars, engaged in activities that are forbidden to God's people, set off on a long, expensive, arduous journey to worship this new king. They come to Jerusalem, they go to the palace, because that's where any of us would look for a king. Herod was not happy to hear their news. He sent for his advisors to find out where the Christ would be born, and the advisors told him. And then we come to verses 7, 8, 9. In secret. Sneaky. Scheming. Evil Herod called the Magi in. Told them where they needed to go to find the king they were looking for. And then he said, could you nip back, you know, on your way home? Could you just nip in and tell me where he is so that I can go and worship him too? Me, King Herod, I need to go and worship this new king you found. It would have sounded feasible to them, wouldn't it? You know, it was a cunning plan. If Herod had sent troops with the Magi, if he'd sent spies, then the locals would have panicked. They'd have run away. They'd have hidden the baby and other child and all their other children. But by being sneaky, by being dishonest, by engaging in works of darkness, he could get the information he wanted without alerting anybody to his plan. He was a liar. But he was a feasible liar. And so off they went, believing that they'd come back and they'd tell Herod where to find the baby. In verses 10 and 11, this journey in that time would have taken a couple of years to organise and to travel, would cost a small fortune. And we're told in verses 10 and 11, the Magi followed this star until it led them to a house and a child in Bethlehem. How absolutely thrilled they must have been after everything they'd invested and committed to this journey. Can you imagine the joy? It says they entered the house, they saw the child, and they bowed down and worshipped. The Greek word that's used, because this was written in Greek, the Greek word that's used that can be translated in different ways. And it means worship as we understand it. It means bow down. One of the meanings that can be attributed to it is that they leaned toward to kiss. They leaned forward as if to kiss. Very intimate word, isn't it, for people who've never met before? They worshipped the child, Jesus. So the Magi were not in the stable. They did not come and worship a baby. Sorry, I know we've all seen it in nativity plays, in schools and churches. I know that we've probably all got Christmas cards with it on. But it's one of those situations where what the Bible says and what our traditions say do not marry up. And some situations it doesn't really matter. But in other situations it might matter. The Magi went into the house, not the stable, and they worshipped a child, not a baby. And when Herod enacted his murderous plan, he didn't kill all the babies in the area. He killed all the boy children 2 years and under. Part of the reason when I read this and I think, no, we must remember this was 2 years later-ish, is because it reminds me that Jesus was God's ongoing long-term plan. It reminds me that God's plans sometimes take a long time to come to fruition. Have you ever seen a sticker on a car or somewhere, a puppy's for life, not just for Christmas? Well, so is Jesus. And to remember that the Magi didn't turn up until a few years later reminds me that Jesus is not just Emmanuel for 12 days in our December. Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us at all times, in all places, because God's story didn't finish in the stable, and God's story hasn't finished yet. It's a work in progress still today. We began with Isaiah's prophecy from Isaiah chapter 60. When these prophecies were being written down, they were a promise of hope. In the midst of darkness, and the slaughter of children in the Middle East is surely darkness, the light of the Lord will shine forth. Mick in our prayer time mentioned John chapter 1 verse 5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has overcome it. That's another one of those Greek words that we can't translate into English properly. It doesn't mean the light shines in the darkness and the darkness hasn't overcome it. The actual Greek word means the darkness never overcame it in the past. The darkness hasn't overcome it now, and the darkness will never overcome it in the future. It's a completely the whole of time word that we don't have an English way of saying without it being a big three-part sentence. Jesus, the light of the world, will shine forth. The word used for magi is a plural word, but there's nothing whatsoever to suggest that there were three of them. There may have been two, there may have been nine, there may have been 20, there may have been three. But the way we talk about the three kings or the three wise men is it's really just a fiction, part of the fictional tradition. It's so easy to be convinced about things and treat them as fact, but we need to check the manual. Now, you know I don't think this is a manual, just a turn of phrase. Jesus said in John chapter 10, the truth will set us free. Search the scriptures. Why do we talk about three? Three kings, three wise men. Could it be because they brought three very significant gifts? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 10 and the Queen of Sheba. What did she bring? She brought gold. She brought spices, and I can't remember the other three things, the other thing that she brought. But the Queen of Sheba brought three gifts, and we didn't say there was three of it. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. This is an ancient story, the visit to the Magi to Jesus. What does it matter today to us? The things that I feel are important to Matthew as he writes this story down are these. I think Matthew wants to remind us and wants to hold throughout history that the only king here is Jesus. Talk about King Herod and look at the destruction he wrought. But the king who matters here is Jesus, King of kings and Lord of lords. Jesus, who stands in such contrast to Herod's way of being king, God's model of human power rather than a human model of God's power. The second thing I think Matthew wants to speak down the ages to us is that at Christmas the angels summon shepherds to come and worship Jesus. And here, some while later, God summoned magi to come and worship Jesus. The shepherds were looked down on. The Magi were Gentiles who engaged in forbidden practices. How could God call people who were not of God's people and who did naughty stuff? God find some nice people to call? Well, yeah. But God chose whom God will choose. And it reminds me each time I read this, each time I reflect on this, that God's ways are not our ways. God came to earth. God took flesh for the benefit of all people. People we like, people we don't like. People who are like us and people who are not like us. God's eternal purpose is not always carried out by the people we might choose, but God's choices are perfect. And I think the last thing I hear in this passage is the word commitment. God's commitment to us in taking flesh. God's commitment to us in keeping Jesus safe and alive from the mad Herod, the evil Herod. The commitment of the Magi, their costly, long journey. Commitment to family and safety as Joseph took his brown-skinned baby and they went and became refugees in Egypt. God calls us to be committed to himself, to one another. God calls disciples to journey and to grow as the kings, the wise men, came round the church windowsills till they finally arrived in the knitted stable. God calls us to journey and to grow as we follow Jesus. Perhaps that's the thing to take away today on this in-betweeny Sunday. Perhaps we think of how we might renew our commitment to the risen, living Lord Jesus. Commitment to pray for those who live in darkness. A commitment to shine as light and to be the light in this community or wherever we go. Our commitment to give our lives anew to God as we come before and offer each day to the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. Let's be still for a moment. Shall we, in our last song, give ourselves afresh to God? I will offer up my life in spirit.